about the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, that gasoline smell. It smells like... victory.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smell of Victory podcast, a line of effort that's part of the national security website, divergentoptions.org. I'm your host, Bob Hine, and I'm joined today by Steve Leonard.
Great to be here.
And before we begin, we want to remind our listeners that this podcast does not contain information of an official nature, nor does the content represent the official position of any government, any organization, or any group. But it should. So today, with the recent discussions about sending lawyers, military lawyers, to assist prosecutors at the border in the Department of Homeland Security request to the Department of Defense to house up to 12,000 detainees, thought it would be worthwhile to discuss mission creep. So mission creep is kind of loosely defined as kind of new or shifting political guidance that requires military operations different from what the intervening force planned. I didn't come up with that. That was from a RAND study. And we think about mission creep, it's certainly not something new. Using the military to assist civil authorities, using the military outside of what the traditional Clausewitzian definition of, you know, kind of fighting and winning the nation's wars has been going on for quite a while. So, matter of fact, the first instance I could find of defense support to civil authorities was the Whiskey Rebellion of 1789, when President Washington deployed the military as a show of force out in western Pennsylvania as folks were protesting a whiskey tax. So this isn't something new. Like I said, it's been going on as long as the Union itself, and there's certainly much larger examples. One of the biggest ones that I could think of was Somalia. Really, which started out as a humanitarian assistance operation, you know, led to Black Hawk Down. I remember I was at the Joint Forces Staff College years ago, and General Zinni, former CENTCOM commander, and he was a general at the operation at the time, he described it as, you know, we went in initially to provide humanitarian assistance, and there were bad guys who were trying to steal food, so there was no local government, so we had to assist them and establish a police force, and so we started arresting people. Well, there was no jail, so we had to start establishing jails, and once we established the jails, well, now we need to try these people. So then we started looking at having to establish a judiciary, you know, and that's kind of when the lawyers came in. It's like, whoa, you know, you're building a nation here. And that's, you know, and so that mission creep that, hey, we start out with this mission, but because of extenuating circumstances or additional requirements, we, the military, keep having to do more and more and more. And probably the best cure for that was the attempt by Colin Powell and the Powell Doctrine talking about, hey, you know, when you start with the military forces, you need a good defined end state, and that's how you, you know, and anything beyond that, that's how you get to that ongoing, you know, kind of Vietnamization of a problem. Steve, your initial thoughts.
Yeah, you hit a couple of good points, and this year is the 25th anniversary of the coining of the term mission creep, which dates back to the 1993 Somali Civil War. So it's really appropriate that you point that out. The other thing that's worth noting that you also mentioned was the Powell-Weinberger Doctrine, which I think, and as we get more into this discussion, the Powell-Weinberger Doctrine is, although there are many people who are detractors of that doctrine because they think that it's too pedantic for the complex world we live in today, there are stopgap measures built into that doctrine to prevent us from going down that road again. Now, that doctrine emerged from the Vietnam War, which is probably the classic example of mission creep in the modern era, and the genesis behind that that doctrine, the creation of that doctrine during the Reagan era. And I think that it's worth noting, and one thing I always take away from the Powell Doctrine is it was designed not just to ensure that we can be successful in military operations, but also that we can avoid the mission creep that is consequent to gradual shifts in policy, strategic objectives along the course of a major operation or something along those lines, or a campaign. because as soon as those objectives start to shift, we lose the focus, and that starts us down that gradual road of mission creep. We've got a lot to talk about today. I don't want to do it all at once, so back to you, Bob.
Sounds great. And this is a complex problem because one of the things we'll talk about, get into, is when you get into crisis response, well, planning for crisis response, or if you want to have a force that's set up for crisis response, that takes investment. And certainly when you look at a ready force, who has the resources to respond to a crisis quickly and rapidly? Well, it's the military. But then there's also some rules, though, specifically that kind of try to prevent the military from really going too far. So there was a rule called posse comitatus, and it talks about what the military can do with regard to law enforcement. And the basic law is, and I'm certainly not a lawyer, but you really can't use military for law enforcement. Now, one of the things I learned was technically, when the law was written, it applied to the Army, was later amended to include the Air Force, and the Navy kind of goes along and has incorporated its own doctrines to make sure it sticks with posse comitatus. That specifically would apply to the Navy in areas that are really so we don't eat out of the Coast Guard's rice bowl, for a say, when it comes to law enforcement. However, there are times when that seam and that boundary have come kind of muddied. There was a couple of instances, like one back in 1993 with the Los Angeles riots, and basically the Marines were called out to assist. There was an instance where a police officer was entering a house. Shots were fired. He yelled to the Marines, cover me. And cover me in military parlance has a very different definition than what it has in law enforcement. Certainly law enforcement, hey, keep a sharp eye. If anything bad happens, help me out. As far as the Marines concerned, it was, hey, we need to lay down this covering fire to make sure that any bad guys are keeping their heads ducked. Now, fortunately at that time, nobody was killed, but it kind of showed the difference between why you don't want to have military doing law enforcement. There was another instance, though, in 1997 when Marines were deployed to the border of the U.S. in a basically drug enforcement role, so trying to prevent drugs from crossing the border. And what happened that day, there was a kid, 18, 19 years old. He was a shepherd. He had a .22 caliber rifle with him kind of to protect his flock against wolves, coyotes, etc. And Marines saw him walking with a gun, shot him and killed him. Again, showing that, that's, again, if you're a Marine, you're 19 years old, somebody comes out with a gun, you shoot them. That's what you're trained to do. That's what you're supposed to do. And so understanding that it's a different role, different mission, and when you start bringing the military for non-traditional roles, that's when bad things can happen. So, Steve, comment?
Yeah, I think what you mentioned about posse comitatus is important because, as neither one of us are lawyers, what this does domestically, it protects us domestically, at least the active component, but it also introduces the idea more and more that when we do operate, that we have to operate side by side with our staff judge advocates to ensure that what we're doing doesn't cross into or doesn't cross legal boundaries. Those legal boundaries are more concerning domestically. I think they're addressed fairly well. But when we operate outside of our borders, those legal limitations are often a little more hazy and necessitate that we have to keep a lawyer close by to make sure that we're doing the right things and not doing the wrong things. And so, yeah, that's a valuable discussion to have when it comes to mission creep. That I think more and more you have to have not just agency partners, but staff judge advocates, lawyers from other organizations close by to say, yes, you can do this. No, you can't do this. And people that we used to stress the law of land warfare, and I'm not sure we do that as well as we used to do that. And the law of land warfare also kind of keeps you out of trouble when you start to see mission creep. It was a good hip pocket reference to have, and it's not something that I've seen in a long time. Back to you, Bob.
I think it goes back to probably two fundamental problems that we have. One, that we the military really don't like to say no. You know, and so when given a mission, when asked to do something, certainly. Or the flip side being, well, we need to do this additional thing to accomplish our mission. And so we don't hesitate to do that. I think a good example of that, if you look at the provincial reconstruction teams in Afghanistan, you know, and that's something where I go back to a lot because, so you're talking about basically a governor, what you could concern, basically a governor, a guy that's in charge of just, you know, establishing the laws, helping the city, making the trains run on time, getting power and water, and something that a commander or lieutenant colonel really isn't trained to do. Yet we had these provisional reconstruction teams in Afghanistan where we had these, you know, young O5s effectively acting as a governor with hundreds of personnel working for them. Might have one person from the State Department who I believe is probably much better suited for this mission as far as basic governance. And this is where just that, but it's something that had to happen if you're trying to establish some stability in the region. You know, you need a stabilizing influence. You need a stabilizing entity, you know, a government, if you will, that's accountable to both the people and the leadership. And so this was a mission that just kind of grew out, you know, kind of creeped into what was going on in order to execute that mission. So I think also, though, so it was interesting, when I was going to the War College back in the 90s, the term, there was a big term called MUTWA. We don't use that term much anymore, but it was missions other than war. And there was a huge debate at the time about should the military be involved in these missions other than war, you know, because we are trained and funded, primarily funded, key on the word funded, you know, to fight and win the nation's wars. But when you start pulling them out to do these other missions, well, that draws from, you know, from readiness, that draws from the opportunity to train for other missions. And to me, the big breaking point for the military where it all of a sudden became, we became just the de facto force for the country that when something bad happens, you call the military, you know, was Katrina. And up until Katrina, there really wasn't that much use for the military with regard to disaster response. But FEMA came in, as everybody recalls, it was just a goat rope. And with there was looting, there was starvation, everything was polluted, there was no stability. And FEMA just got so far beyond what they could do. They brought in the military, they stabilized it. But again, there were issues even then with regard to, you know, okay, how much law enforcement can they do? So, you know, if you've got a young squad of Marines or soldiers out walking the streets and they see looting, can they do anything? And so now there's different rules for National Guard, certainly, and they can be, and so there's a lot better crossover. When you bring in the military to do something, well, then you get what you get. So after Katrina, you know, certainly there have been instances where the military has been called out to support fighting California wildfires, flooding up in the plains. Certainly with hurricanes on the East Coast outside of Katrina, certainly Sandy had a military presence. I remember years ago there was hurricanes Gustav and Ike required military assistance, and it's also become de facto that when hurricane season starts now, the forces spin up and get ready to deploy, get ready to support. But again, that is a FEMA mission. That is not a military mission. Now, there's some times where it works actually very well. And I go back to the Typhoon Haiyan in Indonesia years ago where, gosh, I think we ended up with an entire carrier strike group. There were 13,000 military personnel responded. The USNS Mercy, one of the hospital ships, ended up deploying. And that ended up actually, while not a military mission per se, but because of what the support that we gave, greatly, greatly aided in the relations between the United States and Indonesia. And certainly we can see the Chinese have kind of learned that some of those soft power missions as well. They have now a hospital ship of their own called the Peace Ark, which actually currently is on, I believe, an 11-nation tour. And they're realizing that that assisting, you know, foreign countries can help influence getting into that soft power kind of discussion. And of course, there's Haiti, you know, Operation Unified Response, 17 ships, 48 helicopters, 17,000 sailors and Marines respond. Certainly, there is no FEMA that covers those things. Actually, it's kind of the State Department role in a organization, USAID, and USAID comes in there. Certainly, they don't have the kind of funding that to execute these, and they kind of come in and ask the military for support. We give it, and a lot of times it helps from a foreign policy, not, you know, kind of perspective, establishing good relations. You know, I used to joke with folks saying, you know, sometimes you can't win their hearts and minds, but you can show them we're not assholes. And this goes, I think a lot of these missions go a long way to helping that. Steve?
Now, it's interesting that you point this out, because a lot of my history focuses on military operations other than war, and the formation of a doctrine that allowed us to operate more effectively under those circumstances, whether it be humanitarian assistance, whether it be a peacekeeping operation, whether it be a stability type operation. Going back, what we had, what we lacked, all the services lacked a sound doctrine for how to operate in those environments. And our doctrine before about 2007 literally was, hey, here's a list of things, here's some things to think about, but that's about it. They didn't address the challenges that you face in those environments or the potential for mission creep. And it goes back to the Powell Doctrine, which applies whether you're in a wartime front or whether you're in a stability operation, an operation other than war. The same principles apply. You know, you set achievable objectives. They're finite objectives. You have an exit strategy, and that you work towards those goals in that sense. And so, for instance, you know, when you find yourself in an operation like Katrina, it's, okay, identify the agency who has the lead. Do they have a planning capacity? And most agencies really don't look at planning the same way we do.
Good point.
So they are far more comfortable with ambiguous outcomes than we are, where the outcomes of our planning tends to be very fixed, specific objectives and options to reach those objectives, where other agencies are just really comfortable just kind of saying, hey, we're going to start doing some stuff, and then we kind of hope that it ends up where we want it to, but if it doesn't, we're okay with that too. We'll just kind of play it by ear. We don't operate like that. As America's 911 force, which makes it easy to call, the president knows, hey, if I call these guys, I'm going to get them pointed in the direction that I want with the adequate forces and resources available to do that mission. So going back to an operation like Katrina, FEMA has the lead. We provide the manpower and the transportation. We provide everything that's needed to do the mission. But you talk about an organization wholly unprepared for that, a mission of that size, that scope, and not prepared or planned without, you know, without the op plans on the shelf to pull down and say, okay, what happens when, you know, we get a 100-year storm in Louisiana? We don't have a plan for that. What do we do? And Katrina is really interesting, because if you look at the difference between Mississippi and Louisiana, both states got hit equally hard. And this comes down to it drove mission creep within Louisiana. But you don't really see mission creep in Mississippi. In fact, you don't see a whole lot in Mississippi coming out of Katrina. And this comes down to preparedness, and that the National Guard in Mississippi and the governor had a plan for this kind of an event. And so it was basically a standing order. And if you're a Mississippi guardsman, you can correct me all day long, but my understanding of this is there was a standing order that in the event of a storm like this, that the guardsmen would be mobilized in the event of a storm such as this, but that they were kind of given the latitude to, okay, figure out your own situation, get yourself squared away, then start helping others, and then over time we'll come together, and then the disaster response will be more organized. And so Gulfport, Mississippi, which got hit just as hard as New Orleans, didn't make the news, because the governor of Mississippi had a plan, had a way to do it, didn't need federal assistance really to get there, but within his own state had absolute assurance that he knew what to do and how to get where he was. You look across the Mississippi border into Louisiana, and the governor of Louisiana didn't have the same plan. the mayor of New Orleans was not at all prepared for what was going to happen and what happened. And you see two completely different pictures of disaster response and the evolution of mission creep within Louisiana as a result. And you can look at other operations other than war, and how they evolved to become that way. And it always goes back to there wasn't a real good plan, objectives weren't firmly set, and things started to evolve. And your example earlier of Somalia, and Somalia is the case that we tend to look at for mission creep, and I'm going to wander off the disaster response, but under UNISOM, the United Nations mission to Somalia, whether it was UNISOM 1 or UNISOM 2, there were very specific humanitarian goals set. We put in 30,000 troops to help assure that the security is in place so we can work those humanitarian operations. And that worked just fine until Idid decided he wanted to kill Pakistani peacekeepers. And then the mission started to evolve because we weren't as prepared for what would happen if things went wrong. And we didn't go back and say, okay, the situation has changed. The environment has evolved. Let's go back and rebalance ends, ways, means, and risk. That equation, that classic Lickian equation for strategy. We don't go back and relook those. And as a result, we open the door to mission creep. Because we don't go back and rebalance the equation, and Somalia being the example that, if you remember as well as I do, that was where we found the phrase, do more with less. Because we had Secretary of Defense at the time who didn't give the force on the ground the tools that they needed if the mission evolved or the circumstances changed. They didn't have everything that they were used to operating with because, hey, we were going to try to do this on the cheap and just get it done. And that opened the door to the Battle of Mogadishu and what came out of that, the death of 18 American soldiers. Taking that back into a disaster response context, it's the same principle. It's going in without firmly defined objectives and objectives that are attainable and saying we're not going to sway off these objectives without going back and rebalancing that strategic equation. Because once we change the objectives, which they'll happen, I mean, that's political reality, policy and objectives are going to change. We have to go back and reevaluate the strategy before we push on. We did that in 2011 in Iraq when we failed to achieve a status of forces agreement. We had a set strategy that was built around the concept that we would have 10,000 stay-behind troops. And that strategy didn't change when we didn't get those 10,000 troops. We had 157 troops to achieve the strategic objectives of a 10,000-man force, and that opened the door to ISIS. And again, we go back to stopping to take the time to rebalance the strategic equation and take the measures necessary to prevent mission creep. Now, I'm way off on disaster response. I've wandered from Katrina to Somalia, then to Iraq. So, Bob, I'm going to turn this back over to you, and you can take us back to rainy days in Indonesia.
Interestingly, going back to Somalia, there was a, as I was reading, and as you mentioned before, kind of this is where mission creep originated. And I found a monograph written back at the Army War College back in 96 by Major Michael Beach, where he talks about mission creep. And kind of the way he begins his monograph was talking about how, a basically family of some soldiers that had been killed in Somalia, were talking to President Clinton. And it says, one parent, a Vietnam veteran, told the president he felt that his son had died for nothing. The parents were dismayed by Clinton's remarks, which seemed to suggest that the president was unaware of the military operations being conducted in Somalia. Even more surprising, the tragedy itself was Clinton's declaration of his astonishment at discovering that U.S. forces in Somalia were conducting raids to capture a Klan leader. And kind of this goes to the point that that you were making earlier, with regard to, hey, how this stuff, we need to go back and talk to Congress and kind of get the mission expanded when necessary. Because, you get a better basic mission and you start executing, And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, things are happening where apparently even the president was unaware of that. So we also, though, so as you had said, going back to kind of the disaster response thing, because that's, you know, there's mission creep inside of a current military mission, but there's mission creep with regard to just roles and missions of the military. And I think that's, you know, how we started today when we were talking about the call for lawyers down on the border, or the potential detaining folks up to, I think it's 25,000 or 12,000. And, you know, what is the role of the military? And to me, there was a great example this week of how Congress kind of wants the military to have these missions, or the ability to conduct these missions, in its back pocket. And, you know, right now we have, as we talked about, we have two hospital ships in the United States Navy, the Comfort and the Mercy. And if you go back to, you know, what is the mission of the military but to fight and win this nation's wars? Well, that being said, you know, what? Why do we have hospital ships? Well, certainly, you know, hospital ships, the same reason you have hospitals, and understanding that sometimes the ability to provide the care necessary for, you know, soldiers and airmen and Marines ashore is going to exceed what you can currently, you know, what you have ashore. And as the nature of war changes, as the ability to move patients changes, you know, the requirement for two hospital ships has changed. And as a cost-saving measure, it was determined that we have one hospital ship in excess. And the budget submission reflected as such. And Congress turned around and was like, no. You will keep that second hospital ship. Because they realize, you know, they see, hey, when we have these natural disasters out in the Pacific, in the Caribbean, you know, we want to have this foreign policy tool to use as necessary. Because, again, should the military be considered the first line of foreign policy tools? You know, I guess that's one of the questions that we're debating today.
Boy, and that's a million-dollar question, too. We go back to the idea of the military being America's 911 force. It's an easy decision to make for a chief executive. I need something done. I need it done now. I don't need results a year from now, 2 years, 10 years from now. I need it now. A rapid response. You don't always get a rapid response through the other instruments of national power. And while there might be better diplomatic solutions or economic solutions, sometimes it's easy to lean on the military because you know what you're going to get. But when you do, you've got to do just what you said. You've got to go back and do a roles and missions review before you launch to make sure that you clearly define the boundaries of what you're asking the military to do. So you don't necessarily put the military in a situation that they're not trained or manned or equipped to do.
Right. So kind of, I guess what we've talked about so far is really we've got kind of a good overarching background of mission creep and how it happens. And reason we're talking about it today is, again, is because of the discussions recently about, you know, the Department of Homeland Security asking the Department of Defense to be ready to hold up to 12,000 detainees. Now, I will say this. Secretary Mattis has said that the military will not detain or secure immigrants, and that's again keeping in line with posse comitatus, not a law enforcement mission. That's not what we do. However, there's always a however. You know, when you put 12,000 yeah. people, there's going to be additional requirements. So I would imagine, you know, dealing with potential press, dealing with potential protesters, you know, all these will draw on resources. And while, you know, the military doesn't start out as a, you know, doing in the detainee or securing immigrants position, that's exactly the kind of thing where mission creep could start to come in. Oh, and by the way, you know, think about this. You're a colonel in the Army or a captain in the Navy. You know, you have this base. Now all of a sudden, you have this incredibly huge additional responsibility requirement for infrastructure to support this mission? And you know, what? How will that take away from what else you're trying to do? What can't that base be used for? Just the basic security requirements for the gate. You know, those of you that have not driven on and off military installations, well, generally between the hours of about 6 and 8, you know, there's a line a mile long to get on that base. Well, they're going to have to come up with some way around that, because that's probably not going to work if you're trying to get Shift A and Shift B, you know, out for the your guard force from Department of Homeland Security. Oh, by the way, the other requirement, which has you know, popped some headlines, but not many, has been the 21 lawyers that are being sent to help prosecute their border immigrant cases. Again, these are lawyers that are trained in military law. The last time that most of them were defenders or prosecutors, you know, was at a fairly junior grade. Some of them go on to become, you know, judges, but those judges primarily are dealing with military crime. They're dealing with court martials. They're dealing with, you know, things that military people do sometimes. Again, they're not dealing with those customs and borders. Now, hey, they pass the bar. They are registered attorneys, but not what they do. Oh, and by the way, the JAG force in the military is not one that's known for being grossly overmanned either. And so, again, this is something that would potentially draws away, you know, from what they would and could be doing, you know, for the military. Steve?
Now, it's interesting. There's a parallel, a fairly recent parallel to the types of risks you run with this kind of an effort. So when we talk about the movement of potential detainees onto military installations, we had a fairly significant political debacle that resulted from the former administration's declaration that they were going to close Guantanamo Bay's detention facility, and they wanted to move terrorist detainees or suspected terrorists onto military installations for security. And one of the installations that they looked at was Fort Leavenworth. And as we went through the mission analysis for what would be required for even a small number of detainees, and these were just prisoners, mind you, but the fact that they had to be housed separately, they had to be secured separately, they had to be fed separately, you suddenly deal with protesters, you deal with other security issues, not to mention the fact that you're dealing with people that, in this case, that if they escaped, that, you know, what kind of a threat that they pose to the American public. And the Kansas congressional delegation put an incredible amount of pressure on the administration to the point where they had the swing vote for confirming appointees, and they held off and said, nobody gets confirmed. And they actually held back the confirmation of the Secretary of the Army until the administration backed down. And so now fast forward to 2018, and even though we're not talking about terrorists, we're talking about a substantial number of temporary detainees being moved onto military installations, and a military role, an increasing military role in this whole situation, which is not a new situation, it's an ongoing problem. But as this thing evolves, you move those people onto an installation, you have to provide housing, you have to provide food, you have to provide medical care, you have to provide security, and how long can you hold them, what kind of facilities are you going to hold them in? If you talk about moving children, that opens up an entirely new line of concern. And what happens, and if I'm the Secretary of Defense, I have to look at that. I don't want to say no. Hey, the Commander-in-Chief wants me to do this. I don't want to say no. But not only does it detract from your primary mission, it also, in the eyes of the public, the military has its hands dirty. Because all of a sudden, the military force, which is widely admired by the general public, has its hands stuck in the middle of the La Brea tar pits of immigration. And they're hard to get out of. And that has a great potential to widen an already existing civ-mil gap. And there's just – it's a no-win scenario.
Are we organized? Yes. Can we do it? Do we have the discipline to do it? Yes. But the potential backlash against the military is significant. And, you know, this is one of those things where we have to go back and look at roles and missions and make sure those things are defined clearly, apply the Powell Doctrine to the problem, and make sure that we do the right things right, that we don't just do things. Back to you, Bob.
Now that's a great point regarding the, you know, the CivMil issues, because you have accusations of, you know, being a police state, and when the military starts acting more like a law enforcement force, then there's a general, again, a change in perception.
Right.
But, you know, it's the flip side of that is, as we kind of were alluding to before, what are the options? You know, there's not a lot out there. And if you think about, you know, why do they being FEMA, Department of Homeland Security, USAID, you know, the Congress, why do they keep coming to the military? And, well, you know, if you look about if you need a crisis force, well, somebody that's organized, that has the discipline, that has the manpower, you know, plus you hit on probably to me, which is a huge point, is the lack of other departments to do definitive planning, to do goal planning, to think about, you know, some places do it, as you mentioned, Mississippi. I think there was another case up in with the Red River flooded out a few years ago, and up in North Dakota.
Right.
And they were like, you know what, we got this, we have a plan. You know, they mobilized the city and people filled sandbags and everything worked out great. But not everybody has that ability. And then you get into the, well, what is the Fed's role, you know, in imposing upon the states, you know, having these crisis response plans? And that's a tough question. You know, you get into a federalism discussion, if you will, in that regard. But it's this lack of planning by agencies, the kind of, well, let's kind of roll with it and see what happens, you know. Last month we talked with Corey Shockey, and she had written a book about how it's kind of the State Department's inability to focus on long-term planning and have clear missions and clear roles that's kind of allowed the Defense Department, the combatant commanders, you know, guys out like in Central Command and Southern Command and European Command and the former Pacific Command, which is now the Indo-Pacific Command, but, you know, almost becoming de facto pro-councils, you know, going back to the Roman era, as far as their ability to determine and implement, you know, national foreign policy. So it's, well, I guess, having the other services or the other branches of the government able to conduct that level of planning is helpful, but now we're going out to another big but, and I'm kind of rambling here, I guess, so I'm thinking through the problem, but I guess, I'm thinking, well, now Congress has to fund all of this. So if we want the Department of Homeland Security to have the ability to house detainees, well, now Congress is going to have to authorize them to be prepared to house that number of detainees. Probably never going to get authorized. They're going to have to, you know, increase the number of DHS attorneys, or, you know, that are able to handle detainee cases. You know, how do you prevent that from happening? Well, you don't fund them to do it. And so I think that it's kind of the executive branches, you know, their toolkit, how they've been kind of hamstrung or prevented from doing that by the Congress, you know, because we're probably never going to get there. And so I really don't see a clear path ahead to prevent this mission creep with regard to additional missions for the military and covering for other departments during time of crisis. Steve?
No, you're spot on, Bob, because as long as we answer the 911 call, we're going to continue to get them. If you're on the other end of that phone, somebody's eventually going to pick it up and call you because we have that. We are a ready force to respond to just about any situation, and we don't say no. It's not in our nature. It's antithetical to us to say no. But what we have to do as a department is we've got to be willing to say, okay, look, if you want us involved in this, then we have to force the issue on setting the Powell Doctrine parameters for everything that we do. appropriate to that situation for our own protection. Political will being what it is, that's going to shift. People are always going to call the military. We're not going to be able to avoid these kinds of missions. So there's things that we can do to be prepared for them. One, have doctrine that allows the flexibility to be able to, you know, take our skill set and apply it in the different missions, which works to a large degree when we're talking about disaster response, humanitarian response, a stability operation, a peacekeeping operation. We have good doctrine for that. We have good doctrine for doing a lot of those kinds of things that maybe aren't, that we wouldn't normally lead, but would participate in. But where those missions go awry is where you, what you mentioned about the lack of a planning culture in other agencies and departments. I think the law enforcement agencies tend to have good planning culture, but the other agencies of the government, be they the State Department, Commerce, Finance, the Treasury, don't necessarily have anything even remotely approaching a good planning culture. So they just don't. They just kind of take it as it comes. I hate to say, I think Homeland Security has made a lot of progress over the last couple of decades, but they have made that progress by hiring guys like you and me who have a planning or a strategist background to come and do it for them rather than develop their own internal capacity. So they developed it by hiring guys like us. It works. But the other agencies need to do the same kind of thing, because if there's a potential that you're leading an agency that would have to take the lead in an operation like this, you damn well better take the steps to make sure that you have the internal abilities to lead that kind of an operation. And that's where Congress's oversight role needs to be, and where it typically fails. You know, Congress is really good at holding hearings, but not really good at doing anything about it afterward. They like to tell stories to the Hill, to the Washington Post. You know, they look at this great thing that we're doing, but they don't do anything. They make a lot of noise, and they don't get to where they need to be. And so they leave the door open for not only mission creep in missions that are outside of our skill set, but they leave the door. They also leave the door open for other forms of mission creep as well.
So probably then I would say that our conclusion to this is that, you know, while the military gets called on to do more than they're manned, trained, equipped, or funded to do, that it pulls away from their readiness, pulls away from training, pulls resources away from what they, you know, planning for to fight and win this nation's wars. That's kind of the reality, though, because the alternative is it doesn't happen. And if it doesn't happen, you know, then you end up with you know, thousands of dead in New Orleans. Then you end up with potentially a weaker foreign policy. Then you end up with, you know, the potential for a commercial prison, you know, being set up to hold detainees, which is probably going to end up faring worse for all. So you know, the answer, the reality on this one, I would say it just sucks, but I just don't see any really real alternatives without you know, excessive amounts of increased funding across the board for things that, you know, may never happen, and that's probably not a good use of the taxpayer money. Now, I will say, though, that as these missions do, if they do turn out to become long-term missions, you know, a temporary gap fill, yeah, probably the military, but if it's going to be long term, that's where these other departments need to step up and start doing the planning to figure out how they can take these missions back from the military, because this is not, these are not the kind of things that that we want to roll into our basically standard mission package. Anyway, Steve, last words?
Yeah, I'll add that if we go back to the example of Katrina and FEMA, there was a change in FEMA between the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s, that FEMA used to be a standalone organization when Homeland Security was founded. We moved FEMA up underneath there. But there was another more important change to FEMA that was noticeable during Katrina. And it's something that you have to look at across the federal agencies and departments is who we pick to lead these agencies and if and how we do that. Now, we do that primarily through political appointees. And the director of FEMA historically was not a political appointee, but somebody who had grassroots experience in disaster preparedness or relief. And usually a lot of experience. By the 2000s, the FEMA director was a political appointee. And what happened in Katrina was we gave a guy the lead who had absolutely no experience and no ability to lead an operation of that scope. So regardless of the tools that we gave him, he was probably going to be unable to do anything effective throughout the entire operation. And when you look across the departments and agencies, DOD is typically a rare animal. It's somebody where you might have a political appointee at the top of the pile, but who's our political appointee now? It's somebody who has a depth of experience and knowledge, decades of experience doing the kinds of things that we do, who is more than capable of responding to anything along the spectrum. You don't get the same thing with every other agency. You might get somebody who is a CEO at a pharmaceutical company. You might get somebody who was a proponent of homeschooling, but you don't necessarily get somebody who knows what to do when the rubber meets the road. And that's something that we have to consider and that Congress needs to look at as well is, okay, if I'm going to put somebody in that role, does the deputy also become a political appointee? Or when I have a political appointee as the lead, do I find somebody else? Do I mandate that somebody come from, work their way through from the bowels of that organization to become the deputy, so I have someone experienced and knowledgeable to assist that individual charged with leading the organization? Because let's be honest, when Homeland Security has to respond to a crisis, we don't want somebody that, ran Wells Fargo to be trying to figure out how to respond to a terrorist operation in the United States. We want somebody who knows how to respond to a terrorist operation in the United States. And that's about the only way within the bounds of mission creep in terms of the military taking too large of a role in missions other than war, that we're going to avoid that. That Congress, and it doesn't have to be expensive, but Congress needs to take the steps to use to lean on the experiential component a little bit more in the leadership of these departments and agencies. Beyond that, we're never going to be able to escape the fact that policy is subject to political whims and wins, and policy objectives change. So when we are at war, that we have to understand that that's going to happen. And if you want to avoid mission creep, that means you have to step back and do what I said earlier, which is relook the balance of that strategic equation. And as those objectives and policies change, that you make the adjustments to that Lickean strategic equation of ends, ways, means, and risk. You do that. You rebalance that equation so you don't leave yourself vulnerable when mission creep exists. Back to you, Bob.
Sadly, there's no good answer. Again, it's a hard problem. It's a multifaceted problem. One that, while we cannot avoid, we can probably, as Steve just pointed out, take steps to make sure a crisis that Mother Nature handed you, that it doesn't become exacerbated by the people that you've put to lead that crisis. That being said,
right.
It's tough. It's hard. But so are most of the things that the military does. And again, so that's kind of why de facto it comes back to them. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. And remember, if it's Sunday, it's the smell of victory.